Welcome to Tierney Talks, cause fuck Ted. This show will often feature one-on-one interviews with people I admire about who they are, how they think, what they feel, and what they do. Join me and my slew of wonderful guests for jokes, discourse, confessions, and more. Occasionally, I'll be all by myself, and other times, the podcast will be recorded live at events I'm hosting or speaking at, such as this episode. Tierney Talks presents Coming Out Like a Porn Star with Jiz Lee, Lotus Lane, and Miss Mimosa. Inspired by Jiz Lee's anthology, Coming Out Like a Porn Star, Essays on Pornography, Protection, and Privacy. I read Jiz's book as soon as it was published in 2015, mostly while poolside in Palm Springs. Jiz's book left such a strong impression on me that I spent a few years admiring them and their work at a distance before summoning the nerve to invite them to collaborate. The following conversation, which begins with a couple of readings, took place in the penthouse of the Standard Hotel in downtown Los Angeles at the end of 2018. Thanks in part to Pillow Talk, an event series dedicated to community organizing on sex, love, and communication. Enjoy. So welcome to Pillow Talk. We're so happy that the Standard continues to invite us to host these events. The idea of Pillow Talk is community organizing around sex, intimacy, and communication. So if you ever have an idea for a future Pillow Talk or any notes about tonight, please let me know at the end. We are so excited to welcome Jiz Lee here tonight at my side. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Tierney Finster. I'm a writer and artist who lives in LA. Jiz is actually joining us from the Bay Area tonight, so we're really happy. So I began writing about sex and gender around 2014, or at least publishing articles about topics related to sexuality back then. It was only a little bit into my time covering these topics as a journalist that I realized my true interest in this space. The why of it all, if you want, is to talk more about sex work as a feminist labor issue. I think there's questions around media telling stories that aren't your own at times, but there's also a real need for responsible communication around sex work, and we see that there's a lot of implications of our lack of literacy around sexuality in general, but particularly sex work. So around that time that I began getting really interested in porn and sex work as a feminist labor issue, I came across the book Coming Out Like a Porn Star. This is an anthology created by Jiz Lee, who began blogging and then writing, contributing to other anthologies, and then went on to create your own. So that's pretty amazing. And I've basically been wanting to do an event around the book since then. So a couple years later, we're here, and we're so happy to be. A little more about Jiz. This will be great for you to listen to, huh? Jiz Lee has performed in porn for over a decade, appearing in more than 200 projects from 6 countries, spanning independent erotic films and hardcore gonzo pornography. A versatile performer and key player in the queer porn movement, Jiz has been the recipient of multiple AVN and XBiz Award industry nominations and Feminist Porn Awards, and in 2015 was named an honoree of the Trans 100. Jiz works behind the scenes at Pink and White Productions and fundraises for LGBTQ and sex worker-focused organizations through their erotic philanthropic art project, Karma Pervs. Like I said, Jiz is also a writer and editor, and we're here to talk about the book tonight, which you'll be able to purchase after the event for a very reasonable $20, and so worth it. You'll hear stories from tons of different performers spanning different kind of performance styles, niches, and time spent in the business. So to begin, I'm going to read a little bit from the book, and then Jiz will also. I think this is a really good way to establish the themes, and then we're going to invite a couple other performers up to kind of tell their stories in a little bit. So if you get bored of my voice, please stay tuned. So this is a foreword written by a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, Murray Miller Young, Dr. Murray Miller Young. This was written in June 2015, but is still very much applicable. What does it mean to come out? Where do we come from, and at what point and at what place do we arrive? Coming out has been one of the central issues for the gay rights movement. The idea of coming out of the shadows became a rallying point for gays, lesbians, transvestites, and transgender folks in the 1960s who were fed up with the oppression of silence, denial, police raids, violence, and discriminatory laws that shaped their everyday lives. The famous Stonewall Riots of 1969 and lesser-known uprisings like the one at Compton Cafeteria 1966 in San Francisco's Tenderloin marked the mounting awareness and activism of a new generation of queer people who did not wish or were not able to keep their sexual and gender identities and expressions in the closet. They bravely defied abuse by eschewing the tactics previous generations of queer people employed to survive harassment. They became radical, outspoken advocates for the right to be out and proud and use their visibility, whether chosen or forced, to build a movement that would change the face of the nation. Nowadays, in the age of colorblindness that refuses to acknowledge the abuse of our racial caste system, we also face the unwillingness to see sexual hierarchies and sexualized violence, which are endemic to our society. Here, I do not intend to draw equivalency between racism, sexism, and homophobic repression, or the movements to end them, but to say that these oppressive forces overlap and intersect in important ways. We do not see the absolutely vital ways that sexual difference matters. The abiding injustice of sexual criminalization or the everyday struggles of sexual minorities and how all of these function alongside and through race, gender, ability, age, and citizenship status. But some of us are pulling back the blinders and claiming visibility as a tactic for gaining freedom. That is the story of coming out like a porn star. The authors in this volume are, like their brave foreparents, coming out about their participation in one of the most vilified industries on the planet, porn. In some ways, the porn industry is viewed as more evil than big oil, big tobacco, and big pharma. The porn industry is not simply seen as an agent of greed that destroys our health and our environment. Porn is perceived as the cause of our modern cultural decline, the trafficker of thousands of innocent women and girls, and the purveyor of a rampant and misogynistic prurience that is infecting the minds of our youth. The sex panic around porn is, of course, convenient. It distracts from the more complex questions of what kind of sexual morality should be embraced in today's democratic nations, why so many people choose to work in the sex industry instead of more acceptable arenas of labor, and how exactly youth came to gain an education about sex and sexuality in the age of abstinence-only instruction and the repeal of legal and monetary support for comprehensive sexual health resources and information. This book is so valuable right here and right now, precisely because of these large-scale battles over sexual access and rights taking place. It intervenes in the sex panic about porn by giving voice to the industry's workers, carving through the problematic misrepresentations of porn workers as dupes complicit in their own exploitation. These voices expose how the heavy stigma of porn affects the performers' everyday lives, choices, and aspirations. The disgust and debasement lobbied at porn filters down to its workers. These voices sound off about the painful ways that porn performance can lead to estrangement from one's family and friends. Porn actors find that negotiating the potential disappointment and dismissal of loved ones is one of the most difficult aspects of the job. Facing the wrath or dismissal of employers and colleagues in the straight employment sector outside of the sex industry, porn workers who come out put at risk current and future careers. They constantly face the question, to come out or not to come out. Coming out as a porn star has critical consequences for one's relationships, one's sense of self and integrity, and one's livelihood and social mobility. Coming out means risking everything. Coming out is hard. I applaud the authors in this volume for speaking so honestly and eloquently about their decisions to come out or not to come out. They are both aware of the privilege of being able to come out, as opposed to street-based sex workers who we might say do not have that option, and the profound injustice of needing to decide whether to come out when this is not something that workers in other industries have to face. Lawyers do not have to come out, nor do tax agents or those in other reviled professions. Sex work is one of the only professions where workers must choose whether to admit their status, and if they do,
are potentially subject to merciless harassment and stalking, the release of their personal data online, the loss of custody of their children, and the foreclosure of opportunities for other kinds of work. Given these stakes, most porn workers choose discretion in their work. Some find power in their anonymity and invisibility, while others feel that their race or embodiment already mark them in ways that put them at risk of violence, hostility, and misrepresentation. Still, others believe that we must transform larger ideological and social structures that present porn as shameful and dirty before we can ask its most vulnerable workers to subject themselves to harm by coming out. Yet a growing number find that coming out is a kind of rebellion, an extension of the insurgent attitudes many sex workers already hold towards conservative social norms, expectations, and regulations. They challenge the notion that porn labor is bad and should be hidden, and instead insist on openness, pride, and vocal resistance to the status quo. Grappling with these choices and consequences, the authors of this book show the courage and resilience of porn stars and their deep political awareness. We must listen to their voices and learn from the experts and their experiences. So here, for your reading pleasure, coming out like a porn star, which is to say, with audacity, artfulness, wit, and warmth. Great, so I'm going to invite Jiz to read the introductory essay in the book.
It all started with one ignored phone call from my dad. You see, I'm a terrible liar, and answering his phone call meant having to explain why I was across the world in Berlin. I was there doing porn. I actually just got back from Berlin last week, also doing porn. It's a great place to do porn. And yeah. I let his call go to voicemail and slumped down on the ground. This wasn't one of those moments where I avoided a phone call because I was either too busy or just not in the mood to talk. Now, that one single act represented something more profound and problematic. So jet lagged and defeated, I sat there on the floor, haunted with this realization that I was going to have to finally come out to my family about my other life in porn. How does one even begin to do that? Coming out like a porn star started from the personal questions I asked fellow porn performers as I struggled with the reality of telling my family about my increasing involvement with the adult industry. Were others out to their parents? How do they talk about it to their siblings or their kids? What could I learn from their experiences? And so in asking these questions, I had hit a nerve. Everyone had a story to tell. Some were heartbreaking, others were casual. Some surprised and inspired me. Stories range from funny to fucked up. They taught me about stigma, and they revealed privilege. They gave me relief. They made me furious. They encouraged my own process of coming out, and through their examples, I found myself more prepared. I realized this topic was bigger than myself. Sharing our coming out stories might not only help other performers like me, but may also help people outside the industry relate to us, humanizing our experiences. And what these stories have in common is their honesty. And I saw them as each truths that existed far beyond the narrow moralistic debate of whether or not porn could be feminist or ethical, or even good or bad. The stories ran the gamut, embodying the very essence of the gray area we all exist within. And the details varied differently, but each story revealed what I had long suspected, that although society may think of porn performers as some sort of damaged enemy against the moralistic good, it is actually the stigma from having performed that proves to do the greatest harm and is our largest obstacle. And if we are to overcome these cultural roadblocks and gain rights for sex work, it is precedent that we create a dialogue that stands firmly on the fact that people who choose to perform in porn are no different than anyone else. And if all people are to achieve universal sexual, gender, and reproductive freedoms, it will be through the undoing of the very same stigmas, the sex shaming and the victimization that is found in porn and sex work at large. Hearing the stories from people I admired and respected gave me the strength to begin talking to my family and trying to undo stigmas of my own. So I had been performing in porn since adult videos since 2005, but being in a niche queer porn genre, I dabbled in the early years in relative obscurity without feeling like I particularly needed to tell my family anything. Unless they actively sought it out or a friend let something slip on Facebook, their chances of coming across me were virtually nil. But as my career grew, so did the chances of them stumbling across my photo in a news article. And this hobby of mine was getting serious. So the very real possibility, so was a very real possibility of being outed to my family. I was traveling for gigs. I'd begun performing in Los Angeles. I'd been featured on box covers. I was being invited to speak at schools. I was given awards in other countries. I was regularly contacted for interviews by mainstream press. And years later, when my stepmom would open up her laptop, and the main browser on her laptop is MSNBC, and I was right there in her laptop when she opened it. So years later, I'd exhaled the biggest sigh of relief that she had already knew and was proud and had my back. Yeah. If I start crying, because I feel like I'm right on the precipice of it, I love you. I don't apologize for my tears. This is like an ongoing thing about coming out, and I'm more sentimental when I do have the support of certain family members, and that's when I cry, because I just feel that love. My stepmom is one of my biggest allies. Now I lost my spot. Hold on. Yeah, there is. And so many beautiful people. I appreciate it. It's a good space. But before that time, I had been keeping all of my porn adventures a secret. Despite the fact of like blogging this for every stranger on the internet, right? But like not the closest people ever that are in her family. I'd been hiding all the excitement from some of the closest people in my life. I was keeping it from them almost as if I was ashamed of it. But when in reality, I was very proud. So what was the real reason I was keeping this part of my life from my family? Why hadn't I kept them in the loop? When I received that phone call from my dad, I suddenly realized how far off the map I had drifted away from my family. The distance made me feel as if I was living a double life. But if I didn't tell them soon, they might find out on their own. So I made a sincere vow to tell my dad the next time we were together in person. It wasn't easy. I'm going to skip around a little bit. So please forgive me if I skip the difficult details of coming out to my brother, my father, my stepmother, my mother, and my grandma. I don't want to speak on their behalf, and I'm edging on what I feel comfortable disclosing. The past few years have been challenging, but well worth it. What I can say is that I'm still moved by their various forms of acceptance, as expressed in my brother's curiosity, my father's efforts to empathize. Sorry? No, I'm not sorry. Damn it. Right? I'm not apologizing. my stepmother's supportive role as an ally in standing up for me when dealing with the reactions of less open-minded family members. And to my surprise, my religious mom and grandma's display of unconditional love. They said, a good Christian doesn't judge. That was a surprise. Yeah. 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 My grandma thinks of me like a rock star. I love it. She's so impressed by like all the right stories of traveling. Yeah. Yeah, I actually told them last because I thought that would be the hardest because I okay, my grandmother's, or my mom, both of them actually, they have one of those like holographic pictures of Jesus where you look at it one way and like you see his like his portrait and then like you look at it another way and like he's on the cross. I just had this assumption, like I had an assumption that they were going to be the most judgmental and they were the easiest to talk to. So, yeah. It wasn't and still isn't easy, but I'm grateful for their attempts to better understand who I am. Coming out to them has made me feel closer to my family than ever before, and my heart swells with the knowledge that they love me and are proud of me. I don't consider my process of coming out as over. On the contrary, I still have a very long way to go. It's still an uncompleted project in the back of my head that I'm constantly fine-tuning. And as I continued engaging in conversations with my peers, a few familiar threads came clear. For one, there's what I'll call the snowball outing effect, the potential that disclosing one works in porn can result in the further outing of themselves and others. So for example, one example is working in BDSM porn might also reveal a performer's personal kinks. So when the porn thing came out with them, they also were like, oh, what is this BDSM porn, right? Yeah, that too. So coming out in waves, right? There's also the matter that when we out ourselves as porn performers to our family, they take on the responsibility of this knowledge. So if someone asks my father what I'm up to these days, he must decide then whether or not to talk about the porn career that I've chosen. Or you can choose to focus on my triathlon training, which has become a topic that's very convenient at family gatherings. It's actually, swimming, biking, running. Somebody does one of those sports and they can talk about it, and that gets like all of the questions like, how's work? Or like, you know, have you been on trips lately? It's like,
running is great.
Yeah. Everybody, there's a lot of people that run, or they think about running, or the, yeah. So I've also, I did triathlons, running around, yeah. I've also made mistakes in the process of coming out, many of which I'm glad to see detailed by other stories in this book. When I first came out with my family about working in porn, my dad specifically, I tried to play what I understood as more socially acceptable performances, describing my feature films as comparable to recognized films that include explicit sex, like Short Bus. Right? No, but it's like a movie that has sex in it. Yeah. However, the logic that sex within a narrative plot would somehow be more respectable backfired when my hardcore BDSM scenes were discovered. Although I never said, at least I'm not doing blank, I was too insistent on making comparisons to independent film. We're all affected by horophobia, spectrums of sex worker stigmas, and coming out like a porn star doesn't help to throw other kinds of porn or sex work under the bus. All right, skipping a lot more. Where this book fails in scope, so writers are primarily American, English speaking, and their eras tilt towards a more recent decade. It succeeds, I feel, in being one of the more inclusive anthologies to represent a range of marginalized voices from commercial porn. One of the criticisms I had this book is like, who are all the main porn stars? I don't recognize any of these names. And I felt like it was important to include a lot of those folks that don't get that spotlight. So contributors span people of color, trans and non-binary performers, performers with disabilities, those in niche genres, varying professional experiences. They range from Nina Hartley, a legendary performer with more than 30 years on her belt, to the porn hopeful Verta, who had the door slammed in her face before she had a chance. As an advocate for diverse expressions of human sexuality, it was vital for me that the less heard voices of my peers ring loud and clear. I'm equally grateful to popular mainstream porn stars whose experiences show that our work is more alike than one would think. Combined, the collection features honest and often emotional accounts from over 50 adult professionals, placing it along the ranks of other big porn anthologies. It may hardly scratch the surface, but it will spark a conversation. Working on this book has not been easy. Dozens of performers who initially wanted to submit a story later retracted. This might be typical of publishing collections from various authors with limited budgets. However, in the case of coming out like a porn star, contributors have much more at stake. Writing this piece proved to be an intensely personal process. Even I wanted to recant my own submission. Totally did. Which, by the way, if you want to write a great book, do an anthology and ask a lot of great writers to contribute. Yeah. Their pieces are far exceed my own. There's some really good pieces in this book. For many peers, the danger of being exposed is simply not worth the risk. I understand that. Coming out is hard enough, but to do so publicly has dangerous implications. The experiences shared in this book reflect the social stigmas of a culture whose sexual maturity is still in an awkward stage of adolescence, where media outlets and public opinion continue to portray a negative one-sided view of porn and its participants. Our stories reveal a more honest depiction. We write at a time when sexual knowledge is typically buried in shame and fear and ignorance, where hate crimes against people whose gender and sexual expression differ from a strictly defined template are alarming statistics. The suicide and murder of trans women of color in particular are screaming indicators that something in our understanding of sex and gender is clearly amiss. If our experiences of sexual stigma and its intersections are a reflection of the social inequity of our time, then may our words be a stepping stone for increased sexual awareness and nuances to come. And may we come out on top.
Yes, thank you. Wonderful. I think the last sentence of your intro, when you speak about the need to use words to create more nuanced understanding of sexuality. I think that's kind of the whole point of being here tonight. So thank you for that. And I guess to begin with questions, I'd love to kind of revisit the idea you just mentioned that while preparing the book, you actually sort of wished that you weren't. How did it feel to have such a complicated relationship to the material you were producing? And did it, I'm wondering about the conversations you had with other performers in terms of inviting them to participate and then sort of, you know, fielding fears or wondering if some of that fear actually made you feel that the book was that much more useful or needed?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different things happening at the same time. And one of them was the issue of timing where I'd cast like a kind of a wide net and a lot of time for the call for submissions, but the deadline was shortly after the holidays, and so people were with family, and I feel like writing about complications within family around that time when they're spending time with family made it especially difficult. There was another complication. One of the authors had cancer, and she unfortunately passed away before the book was published. But I was waiting for her going through different remissions to finish it with her sister. And so, like, that finally, she was able to turn it in. And so a long time, there was a bit of time, like, kind of stalling.
Yeah.
To wait for her to finish it. And I think there's the added complication, too, where some of the performers are writers. And they're published writers in the past. They're phenomenal writers. Mm-hmm. And then some aren't, right? And so, like, the idea of, like, writing a story is good in theory, and then, like, you start writing it, and I've had this experience, too, where, like, I have an idea of what I write, and I talk to people about it, and it sounds really good, and then I put it to pen, and it's like, ugh. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a jumbled mess. I think I was fortunate to work with Real Media, where they gave me a lot of leniency in terms of who I asked, very hands-off on editing, which could be a pro or a con, but I really like that the performers' voices shine through. And the process of writing can be difficult for non-writers. For Jack Hammer XL, now he actually has added XL to his name in the time since this has been published.
Volume 2.
Yeah. I just did an interview with him, and then I recorded what we were talking about, and then I transcribed it, and then threw a couple passes back and forth, and he was happy with that, how that worked. And so I didn't have time to do that for everyone, but
that's a cool way of making it really accessible too. I feel a lot of times sending a voice note in terms of journalism, oftentimes people would rather respond with a voice note instead of writing out responses for me.
Yeah, and a couple of them are interviews back and forth, like Danny Wilds is one with his parents, and I think Courtney Troubles also was like, so it's like more of an interview back and forth questions.
It's so interesting because I think a lot of the time we don't hear intimate accounts of anyone's relationship with their parents or family in the way that we do throughout the book. So I'm thinking of Joanna Angel saying that porn made her like her parents, which I think is just an example of how many different narratives there are in the collection.
Yeah.
I'm curious that when you speak about coming out as a continual process, you mentioned how your mother and grandma were people who you sort of assumed or expected a more reactive response in sort of a negative way. I'm curious if on the flip side of that, if there were people who you sort of expected a more embracing or open-minded perspective that wasn't as much so.
I mean, I think I didn't know what to expect, and I expected the worst. Mm-hmm. I skipped over this part a little bit, but like that fear of when you love someone so much, your biggest fear is that you're going to lose them, right? That they'll be disgusted by you and that they won't talk to you anymore and that they'll completely cut ties. And so to have that be the possibility, then going into that is just, it's terrifying, right? It's like, it's silencing. Yeah. Like I would rather be lying the whole time than risk that. So the relief of like my stepmom, for example, mm-hmm. right? When I finally came out to her, and it was, what is that race? There's like I think they stopped allowing alcohol, but there's like a drunken race that goes through San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. my stepmom went to Beta Breakers with a friend of hers. And so we're at some Irish pub, like not even a mile into the race when she totally gave up on it and like, let's go drink.
Cool.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, so she's like a little loosey-goosey and like, she's with her friend who seemed like very like sex positive and, I had gone to Good Vibrations with her and like got her vibrator and stuff. Right. So I'm like, okay, this is going well, testing the waters. And I told her and she said that she already knew. Like, oh, okay. And she's like, yeah, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun. I'm like, great. So she said she read my blog, essentially.
Nice.
And I don't know how she saw it.
She knew it all then.
Yeah. I kind of wish it, I mean, like, you know, and then there's that question of like, well, maybe she felt like she never could tell me that she knew. And
yeah, waiting for like,
right,
you to bring it up.
Yeah, and how awkward that was. And I wish that I had just been open in the beginning. But I also, like, I think that the way my family grew up is, like, we weren't really talking about sex all the time anyway. And that's why, like, now I am such a big advocate for, like, age-appropriate comprehensive sex ed, where we're talking about sex ongoing. The conversation's ongoing. It's not just one birds and bees story and then awkward after that. So I wish that I'd had that environment, whether it was in school or at home. And I feel like it's such a disservice. Like, it's such a disservice that we don't empower or youth, especially with all this sex ed and with that, just that freedom and flexibility of conversations like this, because
totally
would have avoided all this unnecessary
wait.
Yeah.
Also because like you mentioned in terms of some of the work disclosing personal interests, it's sort of like you have to, within many family dynamics, to acknowledge or comment on your own sexuality in any kind of way is already seeming sort of transgressive. Right. So different layers there. So you mentioned the blog and how you sort of were living in public, but also with a ton of anonymity in a certain way, or at least in your day-to-day life, right? So I guess I'm curious, maybe if you want to tell us a little bit about like your origin story getting into porn and sort of the gap between disclosing so much information. You know, you weren't blogging right away, so I guess I'm curious what made you want to start the blog and sort of the process by which you came to like embody yourself online so fully as you do now, because, you know, as mentioned in the book, like you are somebody who people look to as like an advocate and a resource for activism online too.
So I'll try to keep this as like short as possible, but essentially, growing up, I realized like I was queer. There was something, right? And I didn't have a lot of role models. I had two dance teachers in my high school, and they were dating each other. They were husband and husband, and they were a sweet couple role models to have. But I didn't have a lot of examples. And I grew up on Maui, Hawaii, and so there was also like when I was in high school, there was a vote that should we let the state legislature decide whether or not to allow gay marriage, same sex marriage. And there were a lot of like super homophobic ads and just a lot of that out there. So I think like I felt that like this is wrong. It's, you know, like, it felt like that kind of repression, you know, growing up around being queer. I ended up going to Mills College, which if anyone knows Mills College,
good place
is a good place to come out, which is in Oakland, California, and that's what brought me there. And I think it was the combination of now I can be out. I was really exploring my sexuality and having a good time finding that. And then also like the 3,000 miles in between family and hardly seeing them. And also this was sort of pre-internet checkup days. So we kind of like weren't really keeping tabs on each other. It definitely was before Facebook and before MySpace and all that. So I think I just like was able, I was like a horse out of the gate, just like, all right, you know, and the Bay Area was so beautiful for that. You know, the college that I went to, we had like safer sex sluts and they talked about sex ed and I got to learn about sex ed finally in like the, you know, in a broader way than I had when I was in school, when I was in high school. So it was around that environment. I was learning about like open relationships and all these like sex acts that I didn't know about and like, you know, like gender and sexuality and just like this huge like explosion of like really exciting things. And I was loving it. That I'd gone and I'd seen porn in the Roxy Theater, which like, maybe the little Roxy actually, it was a little one. So it was like maybe the size of this room, right? And I had seen, you know, for the first time porn that I related to that looked like my community, it looked like us having sex, like, on screen. And it just was, like, this light bulb moment of, like, I want to do that. I want to be on that screen. And so that's kind of, like, when I knew that. But I think already there had been this sort of, like, rift of, like, I had told my parents that I was dating a woman, and it didn't go very well. So I kind of just, like, I was so busy in my own life and kind of put them to a side and my family to a side. They're all still in Hawaii. And I was just like, all right, the gay thing didn't go very well. So I'm just going to, you know, make my own family or framily or whatever, mm-hmm. friends and family, right? And so, like, I think that I just kind of moved on from that. And that then getting into porn, like, it just wasn't, I don't know, I think that was where the divide really, really happened. Cool. Was that the question?
Yeah.
Like, it's the origin?
I think, yeah, origin.
Yeah. And, yeah. I was at the right place at the right time when I got into porn. So I met someone who was like, hey, my friend's starting a porn company. Do you want to do a sex scene with me? I was like, yes.
Nice.
It was that easy. Because we're all, you know, we're all, like, in community, like, having
orgies
and hanging open relationships. And, like, you know, it's a great pickup line. Like, do you want to do a porn shoot with me? Like, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Cool. So in the intro, there's this idea brought up that it's hard for folks to believe that porn as an industry isn't as evil or nearly as dangerous as less vilified industries, like big pharma or tobacco or oil. I guess I'm curious why you think that is and sort of like how the role you see yourself occupying in terms of creating porn that you're not only enjoying participating in, but that it's porn you actually would enjoy consuming too. I guess you want me to clarify.
No, yeah, I think I know where you're going. Yeah, I think I know how I can take this. I think my stance is porn literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Like this idea that we as a society are, even though we kind of circle around sex a lot, we're still very much afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy of like you're not teaching anyone about sex, and so therefore they're afraid of what they don't know, and we're making really bad choices, and those bad choices are traumatizing us.
Have results to be feared.
Right. So I guess if there's anything I can lend to the industry of like and it's hard too because right now we're having this conversation that seems to be this like dialogue about like it's still good porn, bad porn dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's been happening for decades, and I'm kind of I feel tired of it, even though I think I bought into it early on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where my thing was like a backlash of like how do we see more representations of people who look like us?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because it's very limited, and I feel like that's a problem. You know, when we only have a limited view of like who gets to be sexy, what sex looks like, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff, I feel like that that needs to be broad,
mm-hmm.
right? But in and of itself, I think that like I don't want to shame people's fantasies. I don't want to shame, you know, the idealistic body that's out there, able to be and versatile in all the porn, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just a matter of like the porn literacy and how we consume it and how we talk about it, understanding the process of the production model, kind of dispelling those myths. I see so many like there's like all these stigmas where porn is violent is one sort of myth out there, right? Another one is that it's not safe,
mm-hmm.
which is different from violence because they're not saying condoms. So the average person is saying
it's not safe. Yeah.
All these STIs or STDs or whatever, you know, they're mm-hmm. just saying they're all this stuff, right? But they don't understand the stringent testing protocols that go on behind the scenes. They don't understand mm-hmm. performers like have agency over their own body, and they obviously are going to know we're going to do what's going to be safe for us.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that there's just kind of like these different nuances that aren't as mainstream. Mm-hmm. And just continuing to talk about it is going to bring that out.
Yeah.
I think
it gets confusing sometimes for folks who want to feel good or healthy about porn consumption, but then there's different narratives about what constitutes ethical porn or what constitutes, you know, porn that people are getting paid for equitably. And it's good to ask questions. And I think sometimes, though, there's like such a lack of literacy to start that it can be confusing for some consumers. But I know one of your famous quotes is, hopefully I get it right, be the porn or be the porn you wish to see in the world, a sort of
yeah, or buy the porn you wish to see.
Most importantly, buy the porn. Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote an article when I was kind of getting fed up on the idea of like, but how can I know if this porn's ethical? How can I watch ethical porn on tube sites? And my thing was like, you know, ethical, and we can get into like the granulars of this, but like it starts when you pay for it, right? Because yeah. you, the piracy model is not sustainable, and I don't know. I guess
that's true.
That was in a nutshell. But yeah, there's a larger conversation behind that, but we can get into that later. Yeah. It's too big.
So I guess to kind of finish talking directly about the book in terms of the process behind making it, I'm curious if there are any anecdotes or themes that remain super memorable to you from this edition, or if there's anything, any conversations you've had since that are making you feel a little bit more motivated to create a second volume at some point.
Well, there's follow-up stories to a lot of the stories in here.
Yeah.
My own, I skipped over talking about my siblings, but I definitely have one there.
Because your siblings are younger, right? So it was sort of the question
they're
of
15 and 16 years younger than me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So now they're 18, which was I said, oh, when they're 18, then I'm going to tell them. And then they turn 18 and then they turn 19. I was like, okay, I'm going to tell them. I did tell them when they were 18 and 19. It was okay.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. It was okay.
And then you become such a resource in their life, right? Where there's this increased, you know, degree of willingness to talk about sex and to, I know in the portion that you didn't read, that you had long ago provided them sort of sexual education manuals and
knowing how bad my own parents failed.
Yeah.
It was like Heather Carina, who does, Scarletine, had this book SEX, Guide to Young Adults, Sexuality Stuff, right? Can't remember what the exact title is, but I bought two copies. And my siblings are like avid readers. They were like Harry Potter, like they just like snatched it up really fast. You know, they just love reading. And so I gave them own their each book. And I think that really helped, because my parents would not talk about sex at all. Yeah. Like, it's so scary for them to talk about sex.
Totally. Well, I think it's a good time to introduce.
Yeah, I agree.
So we're going to introduce two other people that I'm going to invite to join us up here. We have Lotus Lane tonight. Lotus Lane is a porn performer, writer, and activist who works with the Free Speech Coalition, which is the adult industry's trade association. She's living in Los Angeles. We also have Miss Mimosa. Mimosa is an artist and sex worker who spends most of her time in San Francisco and LA. She's been working in front of and behind the camera in production, casting, and performer advocacy for 4 years in both adult and mainstream film. Thank you. Are we cool to share mics, do you think?
I think
kind of passed this
share.
Way,
yeah,
too.
We'll share, yeah.
Sure. We got Margo on sound. Thank you, Margo. And if at any point I want to, you know, that there's something you guys want a little bit more clarification on or have a question of your own, please feel free to interrupt the hierarchy of us up here. And later on, we'll have a proper question time. So maybe to begin, you know, the theme of the night is coming out like a porn star. Lotus, if you want to begin, maybe you could each tell us a little bit about your own origin stories in terms of working in porn, motivations or desires related to working in the industry, and sort of your own little personal history of being in the business.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I definitely will get started with that. So if we're going into like deep origins.
Sure.
Deep. So ever since I was young, I had a fascination with sex. I would be sent out of the room when sex scenes were on, and I'd sneak back down the hallway to like see what was I being sent out of the room for. And I remember reading about Greek and Roman mythology and how they had orgies or whatever, and like even seeing that scene in the Ten Commandments where they were like having like the sodomites or whatever, and they were like having all their fun, and then like they got damned, and then they're like being cast away, and I was just like, whoa, like why would that be a bad thing? Everyone looks like they're having fun, and it sounds so amazing. There's food, there's sex, there's dancing, there's music. So I just always had this fascination. Anyways, fast forward to being in my 20s, I kind of like stripped for a little bit, and I was like, oh, should I? And I was like, no. It was like I'm 36, so in my 20s, I was like, what? It was in the early 2000s, and that it was, there was still the way it is, stigma, bad porn. And I was like, no, I just can't do that to my family and my friends and people that knew me growing up. So I didn't. And then my whole 20s, I could not stop thinking about, well, should I be doing porn? And every one-night stand, hookup, everything I had was, oh, wow, you should do porn. And it kind of hurt me because I wasn't. And so I was like, damn, like, what am I doing normal activities when I should be doing this that I desire but is so bad? And then finally I made a pact with myself, like the way people make pacts with their best friend to get married at 30 if no one else wants them. I was like, you know what? If I'm not marrying a politician or if I'm not going to be like some school teacher extraordinaire by the time I'm 30, then I should just do porn because I cannot get this out of my mind. And then when I was 30, I moved down to LA and I was like, I need to make a stripper friend that's doing porn so that way she can get me into porn. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into porn.
Yes. How about you, Mimosa?
Hi. Let's see. So I think that I knew my whole life that I wanted to do it. I just didn't know when. The first time I remember being aware of it was when I was like 8 years old and I found my sister's Playgirl magazine. And I was like, this is a thing that you can like do for a job? Because I knew they were all models, but I was just like, what's happening? This is so cool. And I was like, someday I will do this. I do not know when or how. And I started, I started doing like foot fetish videos, little like tickle videos with clips for sale people. And then I started doing some massage work. I started doing some pro dom work. And I knew eventually I wanted to do porn, but I knew that I didn't want to go like, I knew that I wasn't like very petite and blonde or had big boobs and stuff like that, where I was like the marketable thing and it would be easy if I went into, you know, studios or agencies. So I was like, I need to figure out how I can be in a production that I feel confident about, like being supported by the people who are working there. So I was just patiently waiting for whenever that would happen. And I, one of my best friends that I met in college, I went to a performing arts school here in LA. He started working for kink.com. And I was like, what? And so I was working for a really weirdo kind of dungeon, mostly some weird guy who was kind of like a pimp. But I was like, what are you doing? And he was like, trying not to be caught by me because I came into work and he's like, oh, I can't do things to you because you already know. And so I was just like, okay, bye. And my friend was working up there and I was like, well, if any jobs open up, let me in because I know if I spend enough time around enough people there, there'll be an opportunity. And I was still so surprised that they hadn't really been shooting a lot of BBW women. They had shot April Flores a couple times, and then way in the past there had been a couple models. But I didn't know that going in. So when I got there, I was like, okay, you know. And then I realized that the content wasn't what I thought as far as, like, as much representation as you would think. And so I was like, oh, how am I going to do this? So I kind of just made friends with everybody, and a few of the directors were just like, oh, yeah, you should definitely do this. This would be great. And I'm like, yes, definitely cast me. And so I waited for a while and then started working for Kink. And that was really great because it was like working with my family. They were my best friends and stuff. So it was really wonderful. And since then, I've just kind of been working with whomever I want and whoever wants to work with me. So
nice. Do you think that because you were working at Kink, did you have any less fear or sort of curiosity about how people in your community would react to you, you know, being a sex worker? Or for both of you, I guess you made it clear that in your family dynamic, there wasn't a lot of sexual literacy or conversation, right? So I'm just curious about, you know, the kind of coming out process to your communities.
Well, okay, so when I was about 10... Like, okay, my family was not like, it's not like you didn't talk about sex, but you only, my mom or dad would only talk about it if you asked. So there wasn't really any encouraging, like, go ahead and ask us. It was just like, we'll let school do it. And when I was really young, I used to spend time at my aunt's, who's a social worker, and she like handed me The Joy of Sex, and was like, here, read this. And I loved reading everything. And I was like five, and I was like, oh my God, what? And so she was like, do you have any questions? And I was like, no, I don't have any questions. This was amazing. And so I was like, can I come over here all the time? And I asked my mom when I was about 10, because she found my brother's porn stash. And I was like, what if one of us did porn? And I have eight brothers and sisters. From her only. I have other ones from my dad. And she was like, oh, ha ha. And I was like, oh, no. actually, yeah, like, what would you do? Do you just hate us? Would you just disown us? You'd never want to talk to us again because you hate porn. And she was just like, you know what? Because I don't think this is an issue, like, I wouldn't want to talk about it. I wouldn't want it around my house and stuff, but of course I wouldn't, you know, disown anyone or anything like that. And in my little 10-year-old head, I was like, great, thanks for the answer that will apply forever. I never really, like, have sat down with my mom and been like, hello, mother, I do porn. But she knows. There's no way she does not know. And we've become closer and closer, I think, because of not talking about it. The more that I expose her to people in my life, which sounds really weird, I know, but it's like, it's almost like a respect thing. I'm respecting her boundary of, like, not talking about this, and I think she's respecting mine by not judging me or forcing me to talk about it. And with my siblings, I believe all of them know. I'm, like, trying to go through the list. And I've talked, and there's some that will ask about it, and, oh, what have you been up to? What kind of things have you been doing? Others, they know, but they don't care, and they don't really worry about me. I don't know. My whole life I've just kind of been like, I'm going to do what I want to do because I'm the one living my life. Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, I'm the one in this body. Why is that confusing for anyone? That was something that I never understood, but, like, I understand why people think that way. So working at Kink, because it is a studio, it was easy to be like, I work at a film studio. This is what I do at the film studio. I deal with talent. So I could speak on it to the people who I couldn't necessarily go into detail with, whether it was with respect for their boundaries or, you know, mine. But I don't think I've ever been worried. I'm super, super fortunate that I've never had to be worried about, you know, my family abandoning me or anything like that because of these choices. And I think that comes from my ability to just be like, this is me, or, you know, take it or leave it, you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, you have to repeat the question.
Totally. You know, I'm just curious whether you want to focus on your family or your friends, sort of, as you moved to LA and began working in the industry. I'm curious about how sort of disclosing that information if it was, you know, a specific conversation before it started, or there was a specific experience or, you know, press moment or something that made you feel like responsible or something.
Okay, I got you. Okay, yeah, so the coming out factor. So I was outed. I did not come out. I don't know who the fuck outed me. Honestly, I just know, like, at one point in the early first year of my career, which I honestly wasn't even taking that seriously, but someone, like, showed my dad, and then my dad was like, hey, do you know what real name is up to? And then did this to my mom, and she was like, what? And I was like, oh my God, you guys, what? Yeah. Like, first of all, Dad, why would you do that to mom like that? And then, like, what? Who told you guys? And either way, this is my life. Yeah, just like that. This is my life. So it was like a lot of follow-up sessions of discussions, and this is who I am. This is who I've always been. So that kind of sucked because, like, I really had to deal with my mom's, which I didn't really care too much about my dad's shit. I'll tell you why in a minute. But my mom, I felt more sad about my mom's, like, oh, what did I do wrong feelings.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't do anything wrong. Like, you're so fucking perfect, woman. That's how I'm able to be who I am. Like, I'm not pretending to be someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like so many discussions and sessions of getting through to that point to where now my mom is visiting me from out of town. Like, I started in 2012, so fast forward to now. My mom's visiting me from out of town, and I disclosed to her that I had a really fun time at my best friend's 30th birthday orgy. And then she was just like, oh, I didn't want to know that. But then she was just like, oh. So, I mean, you know, like, the difficult stuff can be overcome, thank God. But when I say, like, oh, I don't really care about, like, what my dad thinks, because, like, that was the confusion part. Like, yeah, there was, like, this shame of, like, don't look at sex and things and all of that growing up. But my dad always was super sexual to the point where, like, it would be like an ongoing joke in our family. So it would be like my real last name, and like if like a sexual indiscretion happened within the family, they'd be like, oh, that's that last name factor. Mm-hmm. And like, you grow up as a little girl hearing this and feeling this, and you're like, so am I cursed with that too? Is that why I have these thoughts? Am I messed up like that? And then, like, on your mom's side, she's Catholic. So then you're like, oh, yeah, you're evil. You're damned. You're fucked.
Yeah.
And you're just like, these are the thoughts that you grow up with. It's, like, so harsh. So, like, that's why I'm just like, okay. So when it comes to my dad's side of, like, how he dealt with it, I'm like, because his side confused me the most, being super sexual, but then being super, like, you better be a good girl. Like, it was just really, like, I didn't know who I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
So as far as the coming out, like, it was just literally like more just like de-escalating the situation.
Yeah.
To now, to where it is now. Yeah. And like, when you said something about, was there an article or an interview where you were like, okay, now I have to face this? Well, they already faced it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when, like, where I was able to put a positive spin on it, this year I was interviewed by New York Times, and that was like such a big, big honor. When you were talking about, you were in it too. Like, who gets to be sexy? And that was the theme of it. Like, yeah, who gets to be sexy? And that was the thought process. When you look at people, like, am I allowed to be sexy? Because I don't look like them. Things like that were being discussed. And I was able to show that to my dad. And, like, he, like, got it. He got it. Yeah. And, like, I was able to talk to him later about the things that I'm doing. He's like, you mean in the adult industry? And I was like, yeah, Dad. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, that's where I work.
Totally. So. Yeah, I think that question of who gets to be sexy is something that is really inspiring to probably a lot of us here. But I think, you know, especially compared to a lot of mainstream media, personally, I feel like there is such a more wide array of representation in terms of bodies and sexual expressions in porn than in mainstream media. You know, like April Flores, who you mentioned, I was totally like, when I found her book in high school, it Book Soup in LA, I was like, oh my God, like, how, you know, I was just so excited to see somebody sexualized like that, because I feel I personally was spending my whole coming of age trying to sexualize myself to make sure someone else did. So yeah, I guess maybe talking more about that idea of what, you know, maybe just at an individual level, what representing your own body in a sexual way sort of means for you in terms of our identities. You would like to speak on too, especially within the BBW space?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a weird thing. Sexiness is so ephemeral. It's like this, it's like you're going, being an actor my whole life, when you go on stage and you're in front of a coach and stuff, and they say to you, like, when they say be sexy, it's like, what are you, what? And you find from trial and error that, like, it's just being you, and that's what draws people to you, is your ability to, like, love yourself, I think, in a way that is inviting, because it's like, when you're your own home, other people will, like, want to be there, and I think,
right, let's give that.
I think people really struggle with that, because they're like, oh, my home is supposed to look like this. I have to make it this way. I have to put it, this needs to go there. Oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed. I have so much to do. There's, and it's like, hey, guess what? Everybody's doing that at the same time. And I think realizing that, like, all our homes look different and we're all struggling with all the things that we think belong and we don't need is like that, I don't know. That, I think sexiness just comes from that. It's, yeah. And so being larger, there was a time when I think it was probably when I was like 13, you know, and my body was changing. I looked like Andy Milonakis a lot at that time. And, you know, I wanted to be this like super duper hoe. And like, yeah,
same.
But like, you can't, like, not you can't, but it's like, I couldn't, I'd be like, what is happening in the mirror? And so I kind of just like, was like, I'm not going to worry about this yet. So I would just like focus on being likable, I guess, if that makes sense. Like I focused on making other people feel beautiful. And then in turn, it's like, it's impossible to really like, not be attracted to someone who is attracted to you, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, exactly. And then after a while, I started becoming attracted to myself. And so then I was like, damn. And, you know, and then, like, my body started changing. And that was when, like, I really was like, okay, all right. And even then, even when my body was had changed and I felt really great about myself, because certain things weren't happening, like boys at school or girls at school weren't coming at me in the way that I saw them going after each other. Later on, I find out it was because everyone was so weirded out by the fact that I like knew what I wanted to do in the world and like knew who I was. And everybody was like, whoa, she's got her own thing going on. Let's like not even go there. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know, having a body that's different for me was always a source of power, because even though we're all the same because we're all different, like I was just like, my mom told me one time, she was just like, you're you and nobody else is you, and you have one body and you can either spend your life hating it or you can look at what you have realistically. If it's something you can change, you should change it, and if you need help changing it, ask for help. And otherwise, you're going to have a really much harder life than you need to have. And I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to you this one day. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I just, it was always something that because I'm different, I harness that. And I really was just like, yeah, I don't fit in. But man, it rocks. So
thank you.
No, thank you. Yeah, everybody. Yeah, exactly. And making other people feel that way by focusing on the things that are so different about people and letting them know that that's a strength, that's okay. Always been something that...
That's a power that you all have.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to note that, you know, seeing different representations in porn can be so impactful for our own personal senses of mm-hmm. sexuality and self-esteem, especially because I think, like, past iterations of feminist voices often used, like, body image politics as a part of an anti-porn, like, feminist rhetoric, right? Where it was, like, idealized images of the beauty standard in a certain way. So that's why I think it's important to talk about, because in so many ways porn is so vast and it kind of, you know, explodes those limitations a lot of the time.
So many categories.
Right.
It's just amazing that you guys are so open and able to speak about, like, your situation and what you guys have been through, though.
Definitely.
That means everything, though.
That kind of vulnerability, yes. We appreciate it so much.
It normalizes the situation. Because you meet people who doesn't feel like they're comfortable and stuff. And when you see women like that, you're like, I should be able to talk about this. I should be able to voice this. You know what I mean? Because we're a community and we are an industry of our own.
Yes.
So even though it's not respected and whatever, whoever the fuck, Grammys, like, you know what I mean? But it's what we have, and I think it's beautiful, though.
That's our own community we built together.
No. And honestly, thank you, though.
Oh,
you know
thank
what
you.
I mean? Yeah, for bringing this type of situation together so people can hear this.
Appreciate
I'm
it.
I'm a sex worker, and I feel like people don't talk about it enough. People don't normalize it enough. People don't realize
in regular situations like this where there can be panel discussions or even just like maybe even porn films at regular film festivals and things like that. Like that, I get where you're coming from, because that's one of the things that I guess is my end goal is with the porn industries. I would really like it to be like a regular entertainment industry, the way mm-hmm. music is a regular entertainment industry and movies and video games. Damn it, stupid video games are a regular industry, but porn is not.
You guys have told someone you're a sex worker, and they're and they're like, oh my God, I need to interview you. You
yes, know, that's horrible, sudden, actually.
The conversation isn't normal.
No, all because the, it's you become like an entity and you become like a thing. And I've had that happen actually a lot of times this summer. Like, whether it's people realizing my age with me being in the industry or just the fact that I'm in the industry. And then all of a sudden they go from disinterested in me to being like, oh my God, now I need to ask you all these questions and I want to interview and now we need to schedule a date. And I'm like super fucking creeped out.
So I'm thankful to have women like you guys.
Yeah.
You have become the one sex worker that they've ever met, because if they've met any other sex workers, they're not talking about it for whatever reason.
They have a type
and so you become their number one resource, where as if you don't do enough emotional labor, now you have to
do more. Like, even on my time off, I need to, like, let them know what my life is about, just so they feel comfortable treating me like a human.
I hate that so much.
And that's... Right, and that's, like, some of the things, like, once I realized that that was the thing occurring, I was like, this is awful. I don't have to or want to educate someone at every turn of my life and existence because, you know, lawyers don't have to do that.
Doctors don't
have to do that. Yeah, they charge yeah. And people willingly pay, so.
But do you ever ask your doctor, so what school did you go to? Oh, my God, so where did you graduate?
What's your favorite procedure to perform?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, because people ask us, so what's your favorite position? Fuck you. What do you mean? Like, you're not going to put me in that position.
Yeah.
So I don't care what you feel like is okay or not. Like, I don't know. Like, I think it's important to us as people that we stand up for what we believe in and that we, like, make sure it's, like, we have a voice outside of this. I'm a porn star, but I'm so much more than that. I'm a fucking human. I got a family. Some people love me. There's people in my life who love me to death. So why would you think that I'm ever, like, I don't have that? People think we don't have that, you guys. People think that people, like, oh my God, you do porn, fuck you for life. It's never like that. Well, not never, because sometimes it is.
Yeah.
But I've been blessed to be in a family that are like, I accept you for who you are.
Because that idea, assuming these things about someone's family or background, also further stigmatizes the family members of people who want to have the honest discourse.
Guess what, you guys? My mom will fight about me. Yes. And it's kind of scary. You know, like, I'm like, Mom, relax. But she's like, no, fuck that. What were they saying? And I'm like,
That's good to have someone have your back, though, because... I think, like, what you were saying earlier, where you're kind of unsure, where you don't even know if people are going to have your back, if you present the truth to them or not, or even when you were like, oh, but what about the people that you thought would have your back but didn't? Like, I had instances of that, too. Like, high school friends that I thought would be with me, like, through thick and through thin, and they were before. And, like, I looked recently at Facebook, and I was like, oh, there's that friend request that they still never granted me. Like, it's still there, like, years later, and I'm just like... Who is this person?
Yeah.
Like, just because I decided to live my truth, they're, like, literally ignoring me forever. It's really weird.
You want
to
know what's fucked up about that, though? It's because you're living your truth. Yeah. And it's like, well, you should be able to understand that I'm living my truth and you're living yours. So regardless if you agree with that or not, you should still be my friend and still love me through that. If you're my friend, then you're going to love me through that process. You're going to let me through whatever.
That's part of the coming out process.
No, it is, though. No, I love that, though. And this is why this book is so important. This is why this conversation is so important. Because we need more people like
that. Somebody said something really impactful to me once about, like, why it's hard for people who are maybe privately, like, family members or somebody who are about, like, support you. Mm-hmm. But there's a double-edged sword. So, for example, political things these days. If I'm going to a Black Lives Matter rally, people will look at that and say, like, oh, that's dope, you're standing up for Black Lives, POC Lives, great. If you're going to Pride Parade, oh, I see you going to that Pride Parade, that's dope that you're doing that. But they're still ashamed. So, for example, I have a sex positive magazine. Mm-hmm. There might be people that privately are about that stuff and feel it and even really want that content in their lives. But if they're, for example, going to a Zine Fest or walking around,
they see my Polaroid nudes on the table, they go to pick up, they might be about it, they don't want other people to see that,
that they're about it.
So it becomes this double
It's like a shame.
That it becomes even harder for people to do this activism work in any way, because there's two levels, whereas everywhere else, you know, anything else you're standing up for, if you're seen, people will even go to just to be seen doing that because they think it gives them cred, whereas like, it's the complete polar opposite with sex work, so.
Yeah, true.
No, 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 I super feel it. So, like, you guys are on the panel right now, and we're, like, asking questions. So what do you do when you come into contact with somebody who feels ashamed that they enjoy sex work? Because when I do it, I'm always like, dude, it's okay. I know you like porn. You know what I mean? Most people do like porn. It's okay. So I'm reinforcing that. Like, is that the same take you have about it? You're, like, reinforcing the fact that it's okay to enjoy porn?
I think it's okay to enjoy porn. I really haven't encountered people that have, like, oh, I enjoy porn, but I have, like, a dilemma thing. Or if I have, I'm...
Even if they don't say it. I'm talking about the person who's sitting there in your face and who's like... Oh wow, that's so awesome. You do this, that, and the third. They're also like, yeah, dude, I kind of watch porn just sometimes. It's every day, you asshole. Like, it's not just that day.
It's
like,
kind of interesting that the coming out narrative is so much based on your work. Your job to say, like, you do porn. It's not, you know,
it's
the
consumer.
Yes, I love porn, you know.
And this is the kind I like. Right.
But people look for that type of validation whenever you have conversations with them. They're like looking for you to be like, oh, no, 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 it's okay that you watch porn. It's okay that you like BDSM. Are you like fetish stuff? Oh my god, that's so cool. Like, they're looking for that. But it's like, why don't you feel good about that on your own? Why don't you feel confident in that sexuality on your own? Like, why don't I need to verify that as a sex worker? Exactly. Which is something we shouldn't even be...
Sex work is emotional work.
Yeah. Oh, no, no, 70%. Oh, my God, 70% of it is me being like...
Are you asking... Are you asking if, like... Oh, sorry.
Thinking about some of the like big news things that have come out about like folks watching porn, like we saw the Ted Cruz thing where it was like
yeah,
yeah, it was a stepdaughter, stepmom, some one of those kind of family tropes. I wish I could remember which company it was. Do you remember? Was it Brazzers or was it? Yeah. So then everyone was shaming him, being like, well, and yeah, if you're hypocritical about that, sure. Then, but they're making fun of him for watching porn. And then there was some like right-wing commentator who was showing an app, a tab on his phone, but one of the tabs was on a tube site that had porn on it. Yeah. But then but then on the flip side of that, then maybe not even the flip side, because then there's comedians who like put porn watching into their scripts, like Sarah Silverman, like that skit that she has in I Love You America, where she's like talking about what kind of porn she likes. But then it's funny because she's like this idea that like you're a woman, you're not supposed to watch porn, but she's so brazen about what she likes, you know.
That's what we should be getting rid of, though. You're a woman, so you shouldn't be watching porn. Are you serious? That's when I get the best orgasms.
Yeah, you just need to keep talking about it. Yeah.
I think also we don't get to hear a lot about porn performers enjoying their job, right? It's just kind of as simple as that. So when we talk about people's shame and guilt or conflicted feelings, it's so much tied to larger cultural ideas of sexuality, but also just the sheer lack of storytelling from people actually doing the sex work, right?
Yeah. Oh, Hot Girls Wanted.
Oh, Hot Girls, yes.
I feel like Raleigh's cool or whatever. You don't deserve to be the person who speaks about sex work.
The voice.
Mm-hmm. You're not the voice.
Yeah. Hot Girls Wanted is a Netflix documentary produced by Rashida Jones and...
I think oftentimes it's so interesting in terms of like when we talk about spheres of entertainment, right? Because Hollywood, obviously perfectly acceptable to be insanely obsessed with mainstream TV and film, but we see what the sexual culture within Hollywood is, right? Meanwhile, like people like Rashida Jones and then just to like name tons of famous actors, especially actresses who as part of their sort of feminist agenda sounds like weird, but you know, they are have such like Hollywood actresses have such a long history of endorsing sort of anti-sex work legislation and stories and disseminating it.
Yeah.
Enduring it.
It's sexual harassment themselves.
Oh my God. Quietly.
Well, so let's look at
there and be like assaulted by an agent or a director, but you won't speak up against sex work. Because whenever you give in to a person who's like that, you're doing sex work. If you're sucking his dick for a role in a movie, I'm sorry, bitch. That is sex work. If you're doing anything that gets you an audition, it gets you forward. That is sex work, boo. Like, it's not anything different than that.
Right.
And the fact that you want to cover it up and use porn stars as, like, a leverage to be like, oh, this is what's happening, that's not fair.
I think also something that's really interesting is someone you would think would be supportive of the industry, like James Franco, who will come in and do a big documentary about like kink and stuff like that, or he creates a show that's based around the creation of porn, and then he'll say in an interview, "I don't watch porn," and it's like, what?
Just researches. He only researches porn. He doesn't watch it.
I don't watch it, and it's like, what? You know what I mean? Those are vultures. That's like, and it's and it's like. It's wild. It's there's so many layers in of shame around it all. It's wild.
I'm gonna just say one more thing and then I'll let it go. But you guys are doing what we need in the porn industry right now. We need people talking about it in different industries and different genres so that they relate to it and normalize it as sex work. It is what it is. We're workers, we're getting paid to do what we do. So to be honest with you guys, thank you. Because enough people don't give homage to that.
Thanks.
Why are we in the shade when we should be standing in the sun? I hate that because I watch Scandal. So if you guys watch Scandal, she says a lot about standing in the sun and like letting the light be on you.
Thank you.
Are standing in the sun right now. And that is what's going to make us more important. That's what's going to make us more money and make us happier as a community. So thank you.
Wonderful. Yes, thank you. I'm going to open it up to questions if anyone in the audience wants to ask any questions. Yeah.
I have a question. So I really related just what you said about coming out being an ongoing process. I don't identify as a sex worker, but I work tangentially, whatever. I mean, you know. In any case, I've had experiences where, you know, my mom's pretty great, but then she'll kind of, like, it's great because she wants it to be great, but she's, like, not really honoring her actual, like, trauma and feelings around it. So, like, all of a sudden something will come up, and then she'll, like, have a freak out because somebody else triggered something in her that she's been, like, holding back, you know? And I'm like, just tell me in the first place. In any case, something I try to, like, explain to her and to a lot of people, because, like, in my eyes, when I think of sex work advocacy, I think it in the same line, like I mentioned before, is, like, Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. LGBT, like, I look at it as, like, an issue that, like, it shouldn't just be sex workers talking about it. It should be, like, in the graphic design industry where I work, where everybody, like, calls themselves very political. How many tweets did I see about sex work cost? Fucking nothing. Mm-hmm. They're talking about everything else. Why are we not talking about this? They're not picking up the weight. Like, we try to, you know, sisters, you know, try to pick up the weight for our trans friends or anything else. So I'm trying to make that correlation with sex work to people. Would any of you have any thoughts on, like, how you view that as such a important and inseparable issue in our society to work towards? Because, for example, you're born Black, you're born brown, you're born gay, you're born whatever. Mm-hmm. It's really hard for a lot. I see it as something that is a value that is, I mean, for one, sex is the most human fucking thing mm-hmm. ever, so that's usually what I go in. But I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts or points around, like, how you can equate that to somebody less in the know, or, like, for me, it is so close to my identity, and I hold that in high regard. A lot of people, they just mitigate it, and in themselves, so they don't. How do you explain it as like an inseparable value that, like, for example, like non-sex workers need to be talking about and working for to help pick up a fucking load, so it's not so heavy for everybody else.
I mean, when I think about sex, I think of agency. Right, and a lot of the fears that I have around limitations and regulations around sex are they're drawing that line, and where is that line, and what is it, like, what does it regulate, and what side of the line you're on, right? And that's where we start to lose, like, reproductive health values and rights, and we start to lose, like, this stupid ass thing about sex being a correlated to, like, the what's in your pants kind of thing, right? Where it's like this is where this line is being drawn when it comes to sex in general. Miles Jackman is a lawyer in the UK, and he was the person who had this phrase that porn is the canary in the coal mine when it comes to free speech, right? And, like, we need to have an expression of sexuality, which, you're right, is so human, because when you draw that line, what happens to that line, and what happens to the people on the other side of it? Because that's where we start getting really dangerous about, like, bodily autonomy.
That's the key word that I think has lent me an ability to, like, reach over the gap. A really good example, which blew my mind, myself and another performer were at the Women's March in LA, and this woman came up to us and was like, can I talk to you guys about your signs? And even at the Women's March, there was, like, this eternal, like, bubble around us, because we were looking for SWAP, but we couldn't find them, so it was just kind of us two. And we were asking everyone with a red umbrella, because there's apparently a lot of organizations that use a red umbrella. We're like, are you SWAP? And they're like, no. And we're like, okay, just so you know, sex workers.
And SWAP is Sex Workers Outreach Project. Yeah. And red umbrella signifies the thing that sex workers used to be like, we're sex workers.
Yeah. And not so I had a sign that said whore power over and over and over and over. And then my friend had one that was stop end violence and stigma against sex workers. So we're walking through and this woman, can I talk to you about your signs? Whore power, what does it mean? And so I just immediately start talking to her, you know, letting her know. And then she starts in on these really, like, incendiary questions, like, with the intent to provoke us. And I glanced at her microphone and it said InfoWars. And so I was like, oh, I was like, that sounds familiar. And so I just kept talking to her, and it went really well, but I think they were bummed because we weren't getting angry. We're just like, oh, well, let me tell you about this. How about this? So then once the video went up, I was like, oh, bring it on, world. And it was part of a compilation that was supposed to show how stupid women are. And all you know, there's obvious comments like, oh, they're ugly, they're whores. And you're like, duh, we're whores. And a lot of them, because we had focused so much on bodily autonomy, like, why are we allowing certain things to be regulated when they have nothing to do with the powers that be? Should not be in my bed, should not be in my pants. Get out of here. Bodily autonomy. So many of the comments were like, wow, those whores are really smart, and wow, I can't believe I agree with the prostitutes. And, like, I was amazed, because it's like, all you have to do is talk about the one thing that, like, yeah, nobody wants anyone telling them what to do. I mean, well, you know, some people do, and then they find that. but, you know, exactly. But I mean, but you want the freedom to choose who gets to tell you what to do, things like that. And that's something that I think everyone can identify with. And that's a really good way to bridge the gap. And there's no way to force anybody to care about something. It has to affect them in some way. And if they can't see it, they can't see it. And you also don't want people. Some people will, like, be on the sidelines of sex workers, or they'll, like, dip their toe in, and then they just, like, run around and are like, I know everything now about it, and this is the way it should be, and to the point where they're, like, silencing other sex workers. And you're like, you don't necessarily want that either, but there is a good way, I think, with, like, a lot of patience and a lot of love. And also, if you don't want to, you shouldn't, again, bodily autonomy, so.
Lotus, yeah, do you want to speak a little bit about the Free Speech Coalition also?
Yeah, and also just to tail end about that, like, one of the examples I use for explaining how to get people to kind of see this in a relatable way, like the sex work movement and why it's important and why it matters and what's a big deal. Like, there's no shame in people going to a restaurant because they don't know how to cook their own fucking food. and paying for it and paying good money for it. But there is shame in people seeking intimacy because they can't make that human connection in intimacy naturally. And you know how fucking hard that is in this world with Tinder and Grindr and all these fucking apps and shit. And besides that, just in regular interactions, how hard it is to connect with people in a real intimate way. So we're shaming people for connecting intimately or from learning intimacy online because we're not teaching it in any other capacity at all on like children, teenage, adulthood level at all. So people are just clueless and they're like yearning because we're human and we're social. This is what we're meant to do, is to interact and be with one another. And we don't know how to because we're preventing each other from learning how to or experiencing how to in different ways because we, as a society, restrict people to relationship level sex. Because outside of relationships, then you're a whore anyways, even if you're not making money. And that's where I think the shame comes from. And that's why I think is really fucked up. Because how hurt do you have to be to, like know that, like, society thinks you're shitty because you can't connect with other people, but all these other people are connecting, and, like, you have to, like, pay for it, and, like, people make you feel bad about that? I feel like that sucks, whether if you're, paying for a video to watch or paying for a person one-on-one touching you. Like, I just feel like that is so painful, the way we treat sex in this society.
Absolutely.
There's
stigma
around mental health.
I mean,
yeah.
It's connected to that.
I don't know if anyone's ever did this.
Yeah, just in general, like the people I know that date, like I see younger people, younger than me, that are in their 20s that have only known Tinder dating style and like
gross.
Have not ever had a real relationship in their life and are approaching 30 and that like literally I'm about to like verge of tears just for another person's like, that's their reality because this society is like, you can't have sex for fun. You need to be in a committed relationship with this person to have sex to be respectable.
And that's not true.
And when it comes to violent, just like earlier conversation, when it comes to violence in porn and the criticisms on that from feminism, so where the fuck else are you supposed to experience violence safely and consensually in a contained environment where you know the outcome, where you know the person, where you agree to certain terms and limits, and they're respected? And if they're not, there's recourse for that. Where can you do that? You can't do that in a relationship.
Yeah.
You can't do that in a fucking kinkstership or fucking adult friend finder, Fet Life bullshit, whatever the fuck they say you can do. You can't. So it's just one of those things that's why I feel like sex, the way society treats it, is so detrimental to people's psyche and the way we just interact in general.
Totally. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, FSU, where I work. So, yeah, I work at Free Speech Coalition, which is the adult industry's trade association. We originally started in the 90s as, like, more of, like, an association that protected the production companies from, like, obscenity laws and things like that being sued by the federal governments or local governments for things of that nature. But as the company kind of evolved, I don't know if company is even the right word. The climate's changed in the industry, and performers speaking out about what their needs and wants are, what really is going to make the industry a better place for them to feel protected and honored, as they are the most important factor in this industry in general. It became more of like, okay, well, you know, free speech laws and obscenity laws and protecting that aren't necessarily the number one focus. They are a focus, but the performers that make this industry what it is should be the number one focus. And I think with our executive director that we have right now, who hired me, Eric, and I got hired in January, so I've only been like almost a year, but like, thank you. Like, the thing is working there, I honestly feel like when I think about it now, like in the back of my mind, and I think about it and I look out into the porn world, I'm like, I think I got what is called a contract, but I'm not performing on film because contracts don't really happen anymore. Like, oh, Vivid Contract Girl type thing, Wicked Contract Girl. That's super like a little bit outdated. And it never really ever happened for any kind of black female performer, especially. Yeah. So I use my angle of like intelligence and advocacy to kind of like work what I could do and like sustain and like bring to the industry. Like, oh, I could bring the gapingest asshole to the industry, or I could bring, you know, like someone that has intelligence and passion to try and like help the industry be better. Right. So
everything that makes you
you. Thank you. So so it's like hard to realize that this is what I've created for myself, because I realize that even other performers, one of the things they're trying to do is like be a contract performer. Because once you're, I realize when you're like kind of a contract performer, you're kind of like made. Yeah. Like you don't have to like hustle for the shoots anymore, right, or like right. work for other companies, because you're already working for the one company that's always going to pay you every month. Right, and that's what I realize now with this position at the Free Speech Coalition, but I'm not trying to take advantage of that and be like, cool, now I don't have to work. Like, I literally am like, like, I am going to work so hard to prove that I deserve this position, because we have, like, a board of directors. No.
It's about everyone.
Right.
It's about everyone.
And not just that, like, if I, like, slack or like am lazy, like I'm not like just slacking and lazy as Lotus. I'm like a slacking lazy black girl. I'm a slacking lazy like woman. I'm a slacking lazy porn person, whore who we already always knew was just a slutty ass whore, not useful person anyways. So like all of this is like, oh, okay, realize where I'm at. Like I gotta really bring it, and I feel proud to, and I want to like help people and inform them of things they don't know, and like DM them and be like, you don't have to do that. You know this, right? Here's the link and the website of where you could do something else instead. Or because I just remember like myself, like how I was, like I did a lot of wrong turns, but they weren't anything that made my life like detrimental. But I realized like that's what happens with a lot of girls, and no one else is there to be like, hey girl, you can do this instead, or you can do this also, or you don't have to listen to that motherfucker.
Lotus.
This exists over here where you can make money.
You can hear women who speak about being independent, and they don't need anybody to be independent.
Right.
They're like, no, I know how to.
Because that's the thing, too, is like I was always an independent performer. I never had an agent.
And you got a position that puts you in a place to help other women versus right. helping yourself.
Right.
Asshole, you're going to help so many production companies become so much more rich.
Right.
You're going to become any more rich because you get same day pay.
Yeah.
But if you're putting people in a position to make better money and more money, that is so much more meaningful to me.
And those are the little things you don't realize until like 3 to 4 years later in, if you survive that long, which is the craziest part.
I love you, Lewis. Thank you so much for being this person, because we need someone to speak out for that.
Anyone else have a question?
No, you can go first.
I was gonna. The Free Speech Coalition is also the people that just started. Can anyone not hear me?
Oh, hi. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the Free Speech Coalition also just start doing subsidized insurance for sex workers, like group buy-in insurance?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. No, like. They started to do some sort of program. I don't remember the exact details, but it's very recent.
Yeah, it's literally, it just launched last, kind of last month through NextGen, but it's not insurance, technically. It's not insurance. It's benefits to insurance discounts or something, right? Discounts. So, like, yeah, so, for instance, like, there was a performer that was sick recently, and he called the Teladoc doctor services, and, like, within, like, a couple minutes or hours, they called in a prescription for him at a pharmacy, and he didn't have to, like, go in a clinic and wait and be, like, there and possibly be exposed to being sick, other people, and, you know, so it was, like, really cool that he even said that. I was like, wow, that worked better than even I thought. I don't know, you know, it's very new. We just launched it last month. Yeah, so, yeah, and... Yeah, so I think I'm going to try it for even my own dental services, because I have two cavities that need to be replaced, and they're $85. So I'm like...
So you guys know how, like, you shave and, like, shit goes wrong?
Ingrown.
Literally, no. Let's be
Vajayshals.
Vajayshals.
Yes. I'm Vajayshals.
Vajayshals. So she would go in and pop everything and pull things out for you that you don't want to do.
But I would also exfoliate and give you like post skincare treatment so you know what to do afterwards. Yeah, I'm a licensed esthetician. I'm not just a crazy bitch popping pimples. I'm a licensed SD. Well-being. Yeah. I was one myself. That's why I'm passionate about it.
No, it's a real thing. Pussies aren't perfect, okay? I don't know if you've looked at your vagina recently. But it's not
I know. They're perfect as they are, no matter what. Pimples and all.
No matter what, they're perfect. But, you know, people like you is like an asset and people that I feel comfortable with. And be like, yeah, pop a pimple on my pussy. Like, that is intimate as fuck. You know what I mean? Like,
I have been so intimate with you, Chanel.
Question. No, it's all good. So this is great to hear about all of this, and I was wondering if there were similar, I guess, coalitions or campaigns happening outside of LA, because I know that a lot of this is like LA based, but I was wondering if things like this have been happening in Vegas or other places throughout the country or outside of the country that have, I guess, like initiated similar protections for sex workers throughout the country and the world.
I know that SWAP, the Sex Workers Outreach Project, is nationwide, if not worldwide. I don't know if they're in other countries, but I do know they're all over this country. And then recently, a Bay Area worker support was started by a couple performers up in San Francisco. And so I think there are a lot of satellite little, you know, groups of people that have come together. But I'm not aware of, like, groups that are similar to FSC, you know, but you might. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, as far as nationwide. But I think that probably the furthest reaching is that comes close to it is SWAP. Yeah.
Something that Ali might be interested in is SLRP. I think that's the acronym. It's in San Francisco, and basically it's a coalition organizing around the decriminalization of sex work, which is sort of a massive piece to address, but they go about it in really localized ways and also have involved like a First Amendment attorney that has a history of like overturning sort of conservative censorship-based policy. So it might be a long road, but it's definitely a cool organization to kind of see the local campaigns. Wendy, can you pass right behind you and I grab
it? Is it okay to ask silly questions? Yeah. Okay. So if you could do a shoot anywhere in this universe, like outdoors, indoors, somewhere on this planet, where would it be? Question for all y'all.
Sky is the limit, like literally.
Yeah. And I just saw what was it called? That space movie that just happened. Oh, God. One Man, was it one? First man. Yeah, that would be terrifying to shoot in space.
That's what I said, oh God.
Yeah. Maybe when the. Yeah. Right. If you come and then it's just like these like little globes floating all around you.
And then you like.
Yeah. You're like a guppy. It's a good question to ask an astronaut. What happens?
Okay, so next goal is like seduce the Tesla guy because he seems highly seducible. Right? I just got to slip him some weed and like be like, get me up there. No. I don't know. Yeah, that seems terrifying. I don't know about outer space, but I don't know. Maybe like something like in a funny apparatus, like an air balloon, airplane, or like I saw one that was on Facebook that was literally people jumping out of a plane like tandem and like having sex, like the skydivers. I don't know that I trust myself and like the other person in that situation. It just looked really fucking amazing.
I don't know, probably somewhere like the Louvre or like the Oval Office. I don't know, you know, something, yeah, something like that. Anywhere, really. I'm one of those people, like, wherever, whatever you want.
Okay, so my question is, one of the ways that they, like, stigmatize, weaponize sex work in general, but porn, is that it's degrading to women. And I like porn in theory, but I have a hard time finding porn that feels like it doesn't have those things. Like, I don't want to be a hater, but I see that. I see why that's a complaint that people have about porn. So I'm wondering if you guys could share some resources. Like, what's some good porn?
Yeah, it's hard.
Buy it. Obviously buy it, but yeah. Where can I buy the good porn?
Yeah, it's hard to find when everything's ranked and weighted and all the common porn, which isn't bad inherently, but when that's all you see. Shinelius Houston had an analogy, which is like trying to find porn that, you know, is particularly not what you're seeing on tube sites. It's kind of like stargazing during the day. You know, like the only thing you see is the sun, but you know there's stars out there and there's constellations out there. You just can't see them. There are a growing number of blogs that have like aggregated and like kind of collected and curated recommended works. Shine started a website, pinklabel.tv, that basically is a hub and like a hosting platform for a bunch of independent emerging artists that are making work that are their alternative to what's out there. So you'll have like, there's like 80 studios right now and growing that are either they're narrative or they're experimental, and they usually show a lot more diversity in the kinds of things that we see like coming out of big studios.
That's pinklabel.tv.
The Feminist Porn Awards in Toronto, which are now the International Toronto Porn Film Festival, they have been watching and awarding and having committees and talks and presentations about porn. And so they have a growing list that are very, there's some crossover and some not. And there are so many more film festivals happening now all over the place, which is really cool to kind of like bring people back in the theaters and watching porn together. And so there's a lot of shorts that are happening. There's like Hot Bits that's in Baltimore and Philadelphia. There are CineKink does a tour, the Hump Festival does a tour. There's Failed Films Festival that happens out here, which is cool because Failed Films is kind of just like it eggs you on, like it dares producers who want to do something weird that they're taking a risk. They're like, bring your failed film to the audience to see. So which I really like, this like the idea of pushing ingenuity and like doing things that are not. But yeah, like there's like a pitfall that happens with commercial porn sometimes when you're making porn to satisfy the demand, and it kind of like sort of like stops any kind of creative process beyond that. So everyone's like, all right, now it's for the, you know, whatever porn's like popular at the time, and right now it's like, you know, the faux-cest, you know, like that kind of thing. But if you're looking for like porn that's particularly like softcore or things that are not like rough or not kinky, sometimes it's vanilla, but like, you know, there are different lists that have been curated specifically for that. There's one that's called the Clit List, which was made specifically for survivors of sexual assault who wanted to have a more narrated, contextualized list of films to watch. I know with Crash Pad Series, which is like a queer and trans site, we have content notices when something might look like consensual non-consent, or might be an act that could be possibly dangerous. So we try to like give more information. But when you go to, yeah, when you go to tube sites, a lot of the context is stripped from it. And you don't really know a lot, you know.
Right, the exit and entrance interviews are probably not there.
Yeah. So there's that. There's we made a softcore list for Crashpad. Yeah, I've had people ask me this before too, because it's hard to find the rare things, especially if you're looking for some like either XYZ demographic that you want to see reflected, or a particular fetish of something, or something that's just like you've been looking, but it's almost a turn off when you can't find it, right? And you want to give up. There are lists out there, and sometimes it just needs like research and homework, and yeah.
Changed so much that it can be great to, you know, locate a performer, and so many have options on their own websites, right, of clips or even custom clips or, sort of source it that way instead of at the tube level where it's all kind of congregating together.
Yeah. Oh, God, like the idea of doing a bespoke custom porn of something that, like, was a particular want would be so exciting to so many performers.
Yeah,
so,
super cool.
Yeah.
And I think that's also, you know, for both of you, in terms of the time in which you entered the industry, there were so many routes, right? Like, I think something that has come out of conversations with different sex workers that are active today, especially marketing themselves digitally, there's so many different platforms and modes of which you communicate with your fans, right? Mm-hmm. I'd be curious maybe if one or both of you would be willing to sort of list some of the ways in which you communicate, whether it's custom clips or texting. I think that especially as culture becomes increasingly friendly to exhibitionism with social media as one aspect, or kind of commodifying like sex worker aesthetics in the mainstream, there's sort of an easy comment people have of like, oh, I should be doing that, or like, that's something, you know, I should just do that. But I think it's like, basically take such massive digital entrepreneurship skills, right? So I would just be curious if, you know, you wanted to touch on that a little bit.
I mean, I could speak to it just a little bit. Speaking specifically to that, I had a friend from San Diego on Facebook be like, oh my God, it's so hard. I should just suck some dick and like be a fucking prostitute or whatever. Like, yeah. It was something really inflammatory like that. Like literally suck some dick and just make some money real easily. And I was like, bitch, let me tell you how easy that is, because it's not.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, like, you have to be really, like, savvy. Like screen whose dick you're sucking.
Yeah.
Make sure that they're safe and, like, legit and, like, whatever, and, like, a real person and not trying to be a murderer, not trying to be a fucking abductor or crazy ass. Take advantage. Take pictures of you that aren't consent. Like, so many possibilities. And, like, people are just like, oh, I could just suck some dick and make some money real quick. No, you can't. Or I guess you can, but it won't be safe, or you won't feel good about it because you did it hastily. And, like, later you're like, wait, I didn't even ask if that guy had an STD test or not. Like, yeah, these are, like, so many different factors that go into it. Like, aren't you even a, like, screener, like, as one of your...
Yeah,
emotions and
stuff. Oh, yeah, totally.
A lot goes into the screening.
Yeah. I think the coolest thing about the porn industry and sex work in general is you learn everything. If it is something that is a career for you, you kind of learn that you have to wear many hats. And I've learned so much about so many aspects because it was necessary to move forward and to develop my skills. And whether it's editing, whether it's shooting, whether it's, like, I'm not very technologically savvy. And so there's all these things where I was like, oh my God, I don't know. I can't do that. That's too many details. And then I was like, what am I saying? Like, just do it. And then you watch someone do it and you do it. And then you learn, and suddenly, like, I'm learning about cybersecurity, which is something it just sounds like a nightmare to me. But I'm like, oh, this is something that's necessary because I need to protect myself and the people that I work with, because I protect like people's lives and livelihood, and their lives and livelihood are mine. And so in particular, I do a lot of screening for different workers, and it's I am very passionate about it because I don't want anybody around people that I love who shouldn't be around them and who they don't want around them. And so I have learned so much about like how to find people who don't want to be found, and how to, just like feel out when someone's a liar. I think you get really good, hopefully, at listening to your instincts. And that's something that can get you in a lot of trouble when you're in a hard place, especially when you're screening for yourself. Because if the money is going lower and you're having to buy things in order to keep yourself going, but then you're not getting the inquiries or the, you can get to a place where you're like, oh, you just let things go and you don't take as much care because the need for money is so intense sometimes. And I really love my job because I get to be like, hey, I know you want to take a shortcut, but I'm not going to let you. And sometimes that might be annoying, but it feels really good to be able to protect people in that way because it's a very neglected group of people in that sense. And sometimes people can't ask for help when they feel overwhelmed, like, I need money and I'm gonna do something because I need it and I'm not gonna take the steps I would. And some people have to be like, stop, go and do that. Anyway, I'm getting off track.
No, you're totally making sense because that's like what I was getting at. And as far as like the many different ways there are to get into porn, sometimes I think what I was slowly getting at is like sometimes people find themselves in a sex work position accidentally because of their position of needing money, and they just accept a situation and then they're like, oh shit, did I really just do that? Or, you know, like with the whole like passing of the FOSTA like regulation, which kind of like made websites accountable for what gets advertised on their platforms, meaning if someone's advertising sex work on their platforms, a platform such as Google or Facebook or Twitter or whatever could be held accountable. So that like made websites really like tighten up their terms of service and all of that stuff. And it really made things a lot more dangerous for sex workers. And when we say sex workers, we're not just saying like prostitutes or like full service escorts. Some of them are dominatrices. Some of them are sugar babies. It's whatever, you know, like different levels. Mm-hmm. Exotic dancers that do private shows, cam girls. Yeah. And like one of the things I've noticed, because I spend a lot of time online just looking and researching and reading articles and reading comments and seeing what the fuck the patterns are, I've noticed because of FOSTA kind of shutting down, a lot more people are being, when I say people, I mean like non-sex work women or people, non-sex work people are being approached on Instagram and like those kinds of platforms in their DMs for sex work. I've noticed that. I've heard this from my friends that are non-sex workers being like, oh, I get those kinds of DMs all the time. It's not just dick pics anymore. It's, hey, baby, how much for a date? Mm-hmm. It's, would you do this for $500? Mm-hmm. Or I got $100 for you. What would you do? Like literally so many different non-sex work people I've known said that. So that's one of the kind of like weird things I've noticed. Like, I wouldn't say weird, but like funny things I've noticed of the passing of after FOSTA. And also made me realize some people may end up being in sex work without realizing it. A girl I knew, she did a photo shoot with a non-porn photographer, but he kind of like ended up coercing her into sucking his dick for the shoot. It was like sexy sex stills, and like she sucked his dick for the shoot. That's sex work.
Yeah.
You know, like things like that are happening to people sometimes, and then they're either have a bad feeling about it or they have like a, well, fuck it, now I'm here and I'm going to do this feeling about it. So,
yeah.
Thank you. I want everyone to be able to have some time to talk amongst ourselves. So is there any closing comments on your guys' end before we move into that? I couldn't imagine a better conversation. I'm so grateful that y'all came here tonight. And for our audience, you've been listening so intently.
I feel like, and Lotus I think is as well, like I feel like a porn Rolodex. So if anyone has any conversation or topic or company or something that they need to get a hold of, if I don't know them, I know someone who knows them. I usually tell this to like students who are doing like papers or something. And yeah, so I want to be helpful in networking in that way. And then the other thing is that I have books that I would love to sign for you, and many amazing stories in here. So,
I'm going to start selling Jiz's book in this corner in a couple minutes, so please consider purchasing a copy, at least picking a copy up, checking it out. We also have gifts from one of our sponsors, Doc Johnson, which is the oldest American sex toy company in existence, located right here in North Hollywood. Yes, thank you, Doc Johnson. So I especially selected the iridescent colorway of some entry-level butt plugs, so please be sure not to leave without one or two. We're also so lucky to have Foria here. Foria is a cannabis based lubricant. I think there's the CBD model here tonight. They also make THC versions. Foria is super cool. It's based in Venice. So please grab handfuls. Like, they're here for you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Oh, and DJ Nico the Icon is about to drop a set for us, so please feel free to move around and dance.
Drop them beat.
Tierney Talks is a 420 talent production. I generously thank my non-existent sponsors in hopes of one day receiving some actual sponsors who I'll thank here. You can follow me on Instagram and even Twitter at TSTAR7. That's at TSTAR7. Follow me. I'd love to hear all of your comments and questions and even some of your concerns. Until next time. I'm too fucking pretty. You can run.